It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It was a foregone conclusion that Rick Santorum would be running for president again in 2016, and yesterday he made it official, announcing at Penn United Technologies in Cabot, Pennsylvania, that he once more will be seeking the Republican nomination. And he set the tone of his campaign with a message of economic populism.
We can create jobs, but as we've all seen, America can't succeed unless we strengthen the first economy, the American family. It's time we have a president who sees the struggle of working families in America not as an opportunity to divide us along race or class, but as a chance to unite us around the ideal that every child in America deserves her birthright to be raised by her parents in a healthy home.
Santorum, a former Pennsylvania U.S. senator, was the runner-up to Mitt Romney in the Republican primary race 4 years ago, but he joins a crowded field this year where his message might very well get drowned out. I'm joined now in studio by political commentator Joe Sabino Mystic, associate professor of law at Duquesne University. Joe Sabino Mystic, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
It's great to be back.
Is Santorum's stance as a champion of the worker something new, or have we heard this before?
Well, it's actually a new and different message coming from a Republican candidate in this primary so far. Everyone expects him to adhere to the conservative social spin that he takes on the big issues of our times. But this message actually allows him to become a fresh face, a new face in the Republican primary after so many years in the political wilderness and after coming very close the last time.
Santorum has a reputation for being socially conservative, anti-abortion, opposed to same-sex marriage. Is he downplaying that now, at least for the time being?
You know, a few months ago, he started making the rounds in Pittsburgh and other parts. And he came to see me at the law school, and it was just a talk. He was trying out his new message, I think.
He came to see you.
Yes. He's not going to abandon any of his social beliefs. He's sticking with those. He's trying to be more tolerant in the public arena, at least for other views. And he has shifted his message away from those things where he's competing with probably 10 or 12 other Republicans right now. And he's shifting his message away from that without changing his beliefs, but he is emphasizing this blue-collar family approach that is something different.
So does he have to kind of tone down the rhetoric on the social issues? And a lot has happened since he ran in 2012. I mean, we've seen same-sex marriage legalized in many states. We have seen, people's stance on choice evolve. And so is he kind of reading the tea leaves and saying, you know, I may believe differently, but I should maybe keep some of this rhetoric to myself?
Well, we've also seen the message change internationally by virtue of Pope Francis. And he's a devout Catholic, and he must hear the Pope as well and what those positions are in terms of tolerance, even if you do not change substantively.
If you are interested in weighing in on our conversation with Joe Sabino Mystic about Rick Santorum, about the presidential race on the Republican side, we'd like to hear from you. 412-246-2002. Again, the number 412-246-2002. 2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter at esspgh. If you heard Rick Santorum's speech yesterday, what did you think? What are your feelings about his message, the way that he is conveying it, and his chances of becoming president? Is he someone you would vote for? We've only had one president from Pennsylvania in history.
It may have been the worst president in American history, too. Yeah, James Buchanan. Yeah,
exactly.
Could have kept us out of the Civil War, but I guess that would have been taking up too much time.
well, we'll see where what Rick Santorum's how his campaign evolves and what his chances are. But what are your thoughts about Rick Santorum? 412-246-2002 to join our conversation. This, of course, is Santorum's second run for the White House. He finished second to Mitt Romney and actually won the Iowa caucuses in 2012.
Yeah, he still grouses about that, of course.
Well, right. And let's talk about that. That was a very interesting situation because he wasn't originally declared the winner. It was so close that there was a mandated recount, and that showed that he barely won, but that, in fact, Rick Santorum was the winner of the Iowa caucuses, and that's the first referendum in the nation, and he feels that that whole situation, the way it played out, robbed him of momentum. What does winning the Iowa caucuses normally do for a candidate?
Well, it probably does less this time than it has done in the past.
It helped Barack Obama,
right? But they've been the Iowa caucuses, the straw polls. They've been discredited in the last round by virtue of some evidence of corrupt practices that were involved in garnering support by this candidate or that. It means less now than it did before, but his complaint is legitimate about the last time out. You look for momentum, and whoever gets it this time will probably pick up some momentum, at least in the media, but you look for momentum, and he was denied that. Actually, Mitt Romney got the momentum. And whether he could have made it all the way or not, he ended up winning 11 states in Iowa. He'd visited all of the 99 counties in Iowa. He was the only candidate to do that. And he manages to combine, as he did then and may try again, a very sharp political mind with boundless energy. He worked very hard. No one works harder than Rick Santorum does.
412-246-2002, the number to call. Let's go to Joe in Hopewell. Joe, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Joe Sabino. Hello. Mystic.
Hi, Joe.
Hello, Professor Mystic. I have a question. Who do you think can take on Hillary Clinton in this coming presidential campaign, and why do you feel? What would be the three best Republican candidates in your opinion?
You're assuming that Hillary is going to get the Democratic nomination, which is not a far-fetched idea, but Bernie Sanders might have something to say about that.
I'm willing to bet both of you some money on that one.
Well, I'll talk to you off the air.
I'm not taking that bet. Well, yeah, I guess everyone thought, the conventional wisdom at least, was that Jeb Bush would be a sort of a middle-of-the-road candidate. The Republicans have a problem of late that Democrats had in the past. There were times when, in order to become the Democratic candidate, you had to be so far left that you couldn't get back towards the center in time for the general election. Well, now, in order to win the Republican primary, you may have to be so far right that there's not enough time to get back towards the center in time for the general election. I would offer this, however, that this election may be decided by a group of voters that are just beginning to feel their power. Hispanic voters may very well hold the key to this race. I heard someone say recently, and I haven't looked at this, but it was another one of those political pundits who said that if Hillary gets 65% of the Hispanic vote, the election's over. You'll just lose so many states to the Democrats that the Republicans there won't be enough votes left for the Republicans to pull it off. So I would think that Marco Rubio's in pretty good shape. If that becomes accepted wisdom, he'd be in pretty good shape to challenge her there. But then again, he's a first-term senator, and Republicans have railed against that for 8 years now. So they may be stymied there.
Barack Obama was a first-term senator when he won,
and that's what they've complained about. And so now they put forward their own first-term
senator. Well, it's not as though we haven't heard contradictions before.
That's right. That's right. Well, in campaign politics, there may be no contradictions. It's you take your best hold.
Sure, but with regard to Marco Rubio, who obviously has Hispanic heritage, but doesn't it really come down to what your stance is on immigration?
Yes, and they're all forced to the right on that issue.
What is Santorum's stance on that?
He's not in favor of making it any easier. He thinks that when we allow people into this country, they compete for the jobs of unemployed Americans who are already here.
So that's not going to resonate.
That's not going to resonate either. The question at the end of the day is, where do they find their votes? If they offend Hispanics by resisting immigration reform, if they hold out against marriage equality, if they win this case in the Supreme Court on Obamacare and millions of Americans suddenly find themselves without insurance, where are they going to find their voters? They're beginning to narrow the field in a sense of where they can garner support.
412-246-2002, the number to call. Again, we're talking with Joe Sabino Mystic, who is an associate professor of law at Duquesne University, about Rick Santorum's declaring his candidacy for president of the United States, second time in the four-year election cycle that he's done so. And let's go to the phones. We have Jeff from Coriopolis. Jeff, welcome. You're on with Joe Sabino Mystic.
Hi. Didn't Senator Santorum pull out of the presidential race the last time, right before the Pennsylvania primary?
Yeah, usually by the time we get to our own primary, the race has been decided. And I'm not sure I can't recall if he participated in this or not, but it's usually of no moment. We go through the motions. Unfortunately, it would be nice if we had it earlier and it could be pertinent, but usually not.
Thank you for that question, Jeff. Let's go to David in Point Breeze. David, welcome.
Hey.
I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Yeah, I've been wondering about Santorum, about, if he's going to downplay or really just not emphasize, his social conservatism, who then would then end up being his natural constituency. And that's the main problem I see with Marco Rubio. He doesn't really seem to have any natural constituencies. Mm-hmm. And they often say, he has that Cuban heritage, but he doesn't agree with Hispanics on the main issues that they care about. And so when I look at the field, the person that really seems to be the strongest is Scott Walker, because as was noted, candidates are going to have to tack to the right, but Scott Walker doesn't have to do that because he can run on his own record as a successful conservative governor who ran on important issues that conservatives like to talk about, like opposing unions, and won, and not only won that, but won a recall election. So, he seems to me to be the strongest candidate that they have in the field, and he's not, a warmed-over rerun from any of the last anyone from the 2012 campaign.
Well, wouldn't his natural constituency, wouldn't that be the social conservatives, Joe?
Yeah, and they're going to divide that up a bit. I'd heard some observers say that there's no room for Rick Santorum in the socially conservative voter base.
No room for him?
Right, because there's so many others there, and that there are other people now, newer, younger, fresher, who are going after the same votes and who actually have a more current constituency there, more current base. But it seems to me that anytime you have a group of people pulling on the same part of the electorate, you divide them up. It's like divide and conquer. I mean, you try to do that on purpose. Here it's being done just by nature, by political nature. So I think his opening up of this other tack, this blue-collar families, the blue-collar worker, I think it's actually, it could bear some fruit. Now, that doesn't mean that, he'll be successful, but he might get some traction. And that's enough to knock over a lot of furniture over on the Republican side and perhaps place himself in a position to make a deal.
And that may, when you talk about going up against the Democratic candidate, and certainly Hillary Clinton would seem to be the front runner, that would seem to be the kind of issue that would gain, that would help a Republican gain traction against a Democrat.
Yeah, isn't it funny how the accusations have flipped a bit. Hillary Clinton is for big money, and and the Republicans are for the working class. So it's really an interesting election to watch.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that Santorum has criticized the Republican Party for, you know, before he gets to, if he has the opportunity to criticizing someone like Hillary Clinton on this, he has criticized the Republican Party for being stuck with a, quote, 35-year-old message on the economy, namely cutting taxes on the rich. If that message, you know, is that message gaining any traction with the party's base?
Well, I think that resonates with average Republicans. They're just average Americans like everybody else. And I think when you start making that pitch, you're starting to appeal to the folks on the street where the rubber meets the road. And I think it resonates.
Let's go to Al in Crafton. Al, welcome. Al, you're on the air.
This is AJ in Crafton.
Oh, AJ, I'm sorry. It looks I'm reading from a distance.
That's okay.
It looked like
that's
Al.
Okay.
AJ, terribly sorry about
that's
that.
That's quite all right. Actually, I've never been a supporter of Mr. Santorum, and there are several issues. And actually, with Mr. Sabino Mystic, when you portrayed him as a devout Catholic, and he is the man who wanted to bomb countries into the 7th century,
yes,
and he's been very divisive. Even in his opening speech yesterday, he's divisive. He also did not support raising the minimum wage when he was in the Senate.
Exactly.
And so
yes,
I wonder how he's going to make this shift. And he also has been, I believe, on public payrolls all of his life. He decries big government. So to me, he is the model of the hypocrisy that we see in a lot of politicians, not all, but an awful lot of them. But he stands out for me, and I guess I think, you know, to change your mood because you see some shifting winds when there have been politicians on both sides that have been fairly consistent for a long time in their support of the working man or working families in a holistic sense, not just in the his view of what family values are. So,
AJ,
yes.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Okay, and you don't have to answer this, but I'm
sure.
Curious. Are you a Republican or a Democrat?
No, I'm a Democrat, and a proud Democrat and a liberal Democrat. I wear those labels proudly because I look at the basic principles behind it. I think that I've not been a fair-weather Democrat. I'm glad to say that, from Adlai Stevenson to Barack Obama. But and not that they didn't have their faults.
Both from Illinois.
But the new, that's right, but the new Republican Party does not resemble the party that I saw as a child growing up when Dwight Eisenhower was the president. You know, many things that he said could have been interchanged with any party, whether it be Republican or Democrat.
Well, that
but
speech
the,
about
the new party is not one that I really recognize.
Yeah, the speech about the military-industrial complex.
Exactly. And
yeah,
every bullet takes food out of the mouths of children.
Right.
You know, that's unheard of at this point.
Well, so, AJ, I think it's telling.
I've never supported him, and I don't. But thanks for letting me say something.
All
well,
right.
I think it's telling that you identified yourself as a liberal and not a progressive. Well, you know, everybody switched to progressive because
right,
the word's been practically
the
ruined.
The L word,
yeah,
right?
Yes,
you
yeah,
can't. You people have run from that, but not so much anymore. Certainly, Bernie Sanders
right,
not running
right,
for it, running
and
away from it.
The more recent poll showing a shift to the left is they're all very fascinating.
It is. It is. And what do you? Well, what do you suppose that has is causing that? Is that the millennials coming of age? Is it?
I think that many of our younger citizens trying to enter the workforce are finding themselves blocked. I think that it doesn't matter what your party affiliation is. They have economic struggles that they have to compete with. And that message about the economy seems to ring true with them.
Let's go to Kurt in West Mifflin. Kurt, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
Yeah, good, thank you. Are you backing up?
I was wondering if you could elaborate or explain the flat tax idea that Santorum has.
I'll let Joe do that.
Well, if you look at the tax code, you know, when I was in law school, which is 35 years ago now, it was a thick book then, and it was a dreaded course for every law student but those who hope to go into that area. It's probably twice as thick now. It is impossible to understand. It really is the haven of the wealthy, the refuge of the wealthy, because only the wealthy can afford to hire those who know how to manipulate it to your advantage. So the flat tax is just straight up percentage tax, and the thought is that it'll be more fair. It's even across the board.
David on Twitter asks, does Senator Santorum rightly consider himself frontrunner based on his being runner-up to Mitt Romney in 2012?
Well, you know, the Republicans always had a rather genteel approach to these things. If you were the next in line, you oftentimes got the nod the next time out. That's all changed now. It's, you know, politics has become a free-for-all. And that's what this primary race is. And the Democrats still have a kerfluffle of sorts on their side, but nothing to match what's going on the Republican side.
Is Rick Santorum struggling to catch on? What are the polls saying?
Well, he just came out of the gate. I suspect he'll climb pretty fast to enough of a percentage that he'll make it into the debates. He was on every national newscast, and if you watch Morning Joe, he was the topic of conversation there for much of the time today. So that alone begins to drive your numbers up, that kind of national exposure.
And he, you know, this is, we should explain the way this works, the prerequisite for participating in the first Republican presidential debate. You have to be in the top 10 of national polls.
Yeah, the average of the national polls.
Right. So, and there's been some talk, and again, as you mentioned, he's just out of the gate. It's early. But there's been talk that in this crowded field, he may not even get into the top 10.
Well, think about how unpleasant that is for the Republican Party. They already have to discriminate. If they're going to eliminate all those candidates who are not in the top 10 average of the national polls, they've already created a cadre of embittered and perhaps even vengeful Republicans as they try to move into a successful general election posture. It's a very difficult spot to be in.
Is it going to be harder in some ways for the Republican nominee because, you know, Hillary will, you know, she'll have her debate with Bernie Sanders and maybe somebody else. But the Republicans, there are going to be at least 10 people in that first debate and a bunch in the subsequent debates. And is there the danger that they could end up beating themselves up so much that by the time they get to squaring off with the opposing party that they're damaged goods?
That's a very real danger. When you have that many people, you end up having a show of hands on various issues, and that tells you nothing. So at best, they'll get their name out there, but every other candidate in that debate will get about the same treatment.
Recent GOP presidential nominees, Mitt Romney, Ronald Reagan among them, needed more than one campaign to win the Republican presidential nomination. Is to the charm for Rick Santorum?
Rick Santorum will have a hard time transitioning into a general election candidate. But can he change the direction, the shape of the Republican primary? Yes, he can. He can be very successful at that, and he's done that in the past. The question is he running for president? Is he running for vice president? Or is he trying to put himself in a better business position through the notoriety of running yet again, where he can sell more books and perhaps charge better or higher speaking fees?
Well, and there is the point, too, that should be raised, that he hasn't been in office since when, 2007?
Yeah, it's been a while, yes.
Josephino Mystic is a political commentator, and he is also an associate professor of law at Duquesne University. He joins us from time to time to talk about politics, and we have a lot coming, so we'll be seeing probably quite a bit of you, Joe.
I'm ready. You call, I'll be here.
All right, sounds good. Thanks for
Take
joining
care.
Us. Coming up, we'll get you ready for Open Streets Pittsburgh, an event where bicyclists will rule the road in downtown Pittsburgh. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This Sunday, Pittsburghers are invited to enjoy 3.5 miles of car-free pavement to do activities that traffic would normally prohibit. Open Streets Pittsburgh occurs three times throughout the summer, encouraging neighbors to get out of the house, walk, bike, skate, shop, and experience their city in a new way. Joining us to explain the philosophy behind the movement is Maura Egler, Commercial District Coordinator for the Lawrenceville Corporation. Hi, Maura.
Hello.
And also Scott Bricker, Executive Director of Bike Pittsburgh. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Why should people attend Open Streets? What's happening on Sunday that they couldn't do on any other day?
Well, it's really a new way to experience the city. There's going to be tons of activities at four different program hubs. There's going to be no cars parked along the route. People can walk, bike safely, stroll with their kids, and exercise without sort of the fear of cars being around them.
Which would be an unusual experience because normally that's what you deal with. Beyond what people can do, what do you hope people will experience, Maura?
Well, I think, you know, as Scott was saying, there are a lot of opportunities to experience the street without the normal car traffic. There's going to be a lot of different kinds of classes happening at all of the different stages. In Lawrenceville, we have yoga, we have CrossFit, boot camp. But also, what's really important for us in Lawrenceville is that people experience the businesses that are there. We have a lot of people in the business community who are very excited about the event. They're going to have specials. They're going to be out on the sidewalk. Places that aren't normally open on Sundays are going to be open up for breakfast and have other sort of things happening. So it's very exciting.
How do you hope that this will change the way that urban residents see their communities?
Well, I think it's going to be a great opportunity for people to really see what it's like to be able to bike and walk safely without kind of the fear of, you know, we have a lot of large trucks in Lawrenceville that can be kind of daunting and scary for people. I think just being able to kind of freely experience their neighborhoods without the threat of, you know, the fear of traffic.
My colleague, Mike, who's he's one of the head organizers of this, he got to experience Ciclovia in L.A., which is their version of Open Streets. And he said there were 150,000 people in the streets just enjoying themselves. He saw smiles on everybody's faces, and that's such a rare occurrence in our urban environment, and we're just happy to bring this experience to Pittsburgh.
And what's the, you know, as you've brought up Ciclovia, what is the philosophy behind it? Describe that larger movement.
Sure. So this dates back about 40 years to Bogota, Colombia, and it really started out as a public health initiative to get people active and healthy, get people who typically didn't have access to park space, access to street space, and program them like parks. 40 years later, they now have 75 miles of streets closed to cars every single Sunday and every single holiday. And they have millions of people experiencing the streets like we're hoping to bring to Pittsburgh.
And how does shutting down 3.5 miles of pavement tie into green thinking?
Well, sure. So just getting people out of the mindset that they have to use their car for absolutely everything, programming spaces along the route to enjoy yourself without a personal automobile.
Are we still in that mindset? I mean,
without a doubt.
Years ago, you could say that. Is that still true today?
It's changing, Paul. But, you know, I think a lot of people still are, it's gotten really easy to use your car for everything. And this is just kind of, flipping the script a little bit and encouraging people to get out and get active and explore their surroundings car free.
There is mention on Open Streets' website that a lot of Pittsburgh's bicycle-friendly businesses are participating in this Open Streets event. What does it mean for a business to be bicycle-friendly, Maura?
Well, I think a number of things. For one, they will have kind of ample bike parking outside of their store. So in Lawrenceville, we have a lot of kind of creative bike racks. And that kind of thing. A lot of people encourage their employees to bike to work. So it cuts down on kind of traffic and parking congestion in the business district. And also they offer discounts to members of Bike Pittsburgh, you know, for a number of different things. It can be everything from a bike shop to a restaurant. So we have a lot of bike-friendly businesses in Lawrenceville.
We're talking about the Open Streets Pittsburgh event, which is taking place on Sunday, and it's from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. this Sunday, May 31st. So if you've always, you know, if you've taken your bike out on the road and you've said, God, I would love to do this without all these cars and trucks around, well, this is your chance for 4 blissful hours on Sunday morning. Is Pittsburgh a leader in having bicycle-friendly businesses? What's the benefit for a local business to participate in this? We know what the benefit is for the bikers. What about the businesses?
Sure. Actually, we're in the top 5 cities in the country for the number of bike-friendly businesses.
Who's number one?
Number one, I feel like it's Boise, Idaho, although I'm not completely positive on that. We were neck and neck with them as of a year ago. It's changed slightly in the last year. But yeah, you know, a lot of businesses are trying to differentiate themselves or trying to encourage more of their customers and employees to ride and get healthy that way and to free up parking spaces for even other for other customers. I think it's really about attracting a different demographic to your shop or to your business. And, you know, it's very much the zeitgeist of today. So I think you're going to see more and more businesses wanting to attract bicyclists.
Is it harder in a city like Pittsburgh to do this? When you mentioned Boise being at the top of the list, that I've never been there, but my understanding of the way the city is set up is much more open. Roads are wider. I mean, in an older city like this, you have tight turns, you have narrow streets. Just, you know, crazy streets that go all over the place that sometimes don't seem to make sense. So does that just the topography and the layout of the city make it more of a challenge to do things like what you're advocating for?
Certainly there are some challenges that we face in Pittsburgh that some flatter cities don't face. But you know what? Those cities don't get downhills, and those are some of the most fun things you can experience on a bike. They don't get the vista views, the beautiful vista views that you see in the city of Pittsburgh. It's really a fun city to explore. It's a tight city. It's a dense city, only 54 square miles. And, you know, you really get a sense of place here. It's a great place to bike and to walk. You can easily get to your destination within a half hour of leaving your house. And it's, you know, it actually is safe to ride here. We have a great network of bike lanes and trails throughout the city, and more business districts have bike racks, and more corporations downtown in Oakland have bike parking facilities for their employees.
How is this one day in the summer changing the lifestyles of Pittsburghers as a whole? How is it making us a more active city? Can a 4-hour event, you know, change people's habits and outlook?
Sure. Well, I mean, that's putting a lot of pressure on this event, Paul.
Well, but I mean, that's part of why you're doing it, isn't
sure.
it?
Sure. No, it's really introducing people to a new way to experience their city. We are going to have 3 of these events. So, you know, we're hoping to build on them. And hopefully, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, we are more like Bogota and having them, you know, throughout the spring, summer and fall and, you know, on holidays and things like that. We have to start somewhere. We're really excited about this Sunday's event. We think we're going to attract thousands and thousands of people throughout the region to the streets and experience Pittsburgh in a way that is just completely magical.
And Maura, who are Open Streets partners?
Well, partners, we have a number of partners. There's us, the Lawrenceville Corporation, our sister organization, Lawrenceville United, Neighbors in the Strip, Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership, Allegheny County, Mayor Peduto's office, AARP, Highmark, Colcom, Heinz Endowments, Benter Foundation, Grable Foundation, Cultural Trust, and our communications team, the Red House.
So a lot of people have bought into this and say, sign us up. This is a good idea.
Mm-hmm. And we have a core group of volunteers as well. There's probably a good three or four people who aren't really affiliated with organizations, and they've been dedicating their time and energy to making sure this happens. And this has been a couple years in the works now. It's a very complicated event to put on, and we have actually over 300 volunteers scheduled to help us on Sunday.
It's Open Streets Pittsburgh. It's happening on Sunday, this Sunday, May 31st, from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. And it goes from downtown Pittsburgh through the Strip and into Lawrenceville. So it's 4 hours and 3.5 miles for you to bring anything other than a motorized vehicle to the pavement. So you can bike, walk, skate, whatever is your favorite form of non-motorized transportation. I want to thank both of our guests for explaining the philosophy behind this. Maura Egler, Commercial District Coordinator of the Lawrenceville Corporation. Thank you, Maura.
Thank you, Paul.
Scott Bricker, Executive Director of Bike Pittsburgh. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Paul.
Coming up, travel contributor Elaine LaBaume on why you're never too old for summer camp. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up, travel contributor Elaine LaBaume looks at summer camps for adults. But first, each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
If you look real closely, you can see where they've drilled through the rock to put in their dynamite and blast it out. And that's where the mound would have been.
Mark McConaughey is a regional archaeologist for the Pennsylvania Bureau of Historic Preservation. He's standing in the Bottoms neighborhood, with his back to the railroad tracks that skirt the Ohio River's high embankment. He points up to the exposed rock of a bluff.
There's no mound left up there at all.
During the early woodland period, which began around 1100 BC, a group called the Adena lived throughout southwestern Pennsylvania and the northern panhandle of West Virginia. Primarily hunter-gatherers, the Adena also fished, and they buried their dead in mounds like the one that used to overlook the Ohio.
A lot of them probably were along the rivers, and because of the construction of steel mills and other industrial things along the Ohio and Monongahela, they're long gone.
In 1896, Frank Jourdette, the first director of Carnegie Museum of Natural History, excavated the two main burials in the early woodland portion of the 16-foot high mound, but he left the other half untouched. The artifacts, human remains, pearl beads, conch shell beads, scapula awls, currently reside at the Research Center on Baum Boulevard. Deborah Harding is collection manager of anthropology at Carnegie Museum of Natural History. She takes off her gloves and says, digging up the dead raises big questions of mortality, religious practice, and respect. The McKees Rocks Mound has a history of controversy that begins with Jourdette.
Stories started going in the bars in McKees Rocks that he was digging up white people. And all of a sudden, it wasn't such a good deal anymore.
Shortly thereafter, Jourdette quit, or was fired. He gave up archaeology and became a lawyer. In 2010, a few protesters petitioned to repatriate the mound's human remains, but they failed to follow the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act of 1990, which requires that cultural affiliation be established before claiming any remains or artifacts. So, the McKees Rocks artifacts remain in Pittsburgh, classified as culturally unidentifiable.
I think it's the beginning of complex societies in the region.
McConaughey believes the burials provide evidence of a stratified society, especially as more sites are discovered.
We know a little bit more about these people, and it's time to, again, try to synthesize what we do know and get some idea of how they're living in general in this region.
Harding says investigating burial practices helps us learn about other societies, as well as our own.
We don't know what comes after. We're all looking for answers, which we're not going to get on this side. But, you know, it's something universal. Everybody is born, and dies. So how you deal with it is always fascinating.
For 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
UPMC is proud to support 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. What images come to mind when you mention summer camp? Cabins in the wilderness with young campers, craft projects, water activities. While those bucolic images apply to many of these spots, camping isn't just for kids. Contributor Elaine LaBalm, who tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town and is always a happy camper, joins us this week to tell us about the joys of summer camp for adults. Elaine, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, I'm great and good to see you, Paul.
Yeah, thanks for filling in for me last week.
A pleasure.
Now, New Girl, you're telling us the fun of summer camp doesn't have to end once you turn 21. I'm all ears here. Well,
you know, what I love about this is that, you know, a lot of us are, you know, now researching summer camps for our kids, sending them off. And there's just that little twinge of like, dang, it's like, you know, why can't I go to band camp or something like this? And I think what these adult camps do is they satisfy a couple of different urges. One, that you just, you need this kind of like downtime just to like think and daydream and just really relax and unwind. And an adult camp, summer camp, can do that. There is one actually in Honesdale, PA. Don't know if you know where that is. It's just due north of Scranton, small town. It's called Soul Camp. And this thing is nationally known. It's this four-day mind and soul experience, they call it. So yoga, meditation, arts and crafts. They say, you know, bring out your inner hippie. It's, you know, you don't have to be a hippie to go. But think about how nice it would be to decompress in a place, a sweet, like you said, bucolic place like that. Or the other thing that it does for you is that we've all got these various things on our bucket list. We want to become a better chef, or, you know, learn how to do, you know, pottery, what have you. So you can then find a camp to satisfy a particular urge. Another one that's just up the road in Farmington in the Laurel Highlands is the Touchstone Center for Crafts. We may have talked about it over the years. It's this terrific place. You get a week-long camp, and you can do, you know, ceramics and blacksmithing and glasswork and textiles and all kinds of things. So whether you just want to completely chill out or just, you know, satisfy one of those cravings that you've had for a long time, this is a great way to do it.
Do you remember the TV show Camp Runamuck?
It was about
kids camp where everything just, you know, they go crazy, but it's mostly about the adults, you know,
who are the camp counselors.
Right. So I'm envisioning like these people who maybe worked as counselors at camps and now they're going to camps themselves. And so it's like this role reversal thing.
Yeah, maybe. You know, that's probably some of it. But I've talked to people who've gone to some of these adult camps, and I'm not sure that a lot of them actually went to camp. I just think they just need that break, and they need that something special that they've been wanting to satisfy or nurture. And that's what this is about. Or maybe they just look at their kids and they say, you're having too much fun. I need a piece of this action.
Exactly. So you brought a Fab Five list today, and first up is Camp Wandawega in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. Really, Wisconsin?
Absolutely.
That's the first place we're going?
Paul, this is the one that is at the top of my list, and this is the one that I want to go to the most. This is the one that, to me, feels and sounds the most like just the perfect summer camp for adults. It's in this. It's been something of a lakefront resort for almost a century, and it's this beautiful place now owned by a couple, a youngish couple who are ad execs in Chicago. So this is up the road from Chicago, a little ways, but not terribly far. And they've just set up on their property. They've got bunch of different cabins. You could camp if you want. No specific set agenda, but you can canoe, you can hike, you can do, you know, tell stories around the bonfire. There's art. There's actually an adult band camp if you want to satisfy that urge. But by the same token, there's, you know, a variety of restaurants close by, or you can do these wonderful outdoor meals under the stars. So it's this very sort of relaxed, laid-back camp that has so many options. You can literally do a ton or do very, very little in a beautiful, beautiful setting. This one's absolutely at the top of my list. Would love to go.
And okay, as long as you're talking about like a fantasy style camp, there's a rock and roll fantasy camp in Las Vegas. I mean, is That is a thing?
That truly is a thing now. And this one just sounds outrageous. I know you're not a fan of Las Vegas, Paul, but this would
get you to Las Vegas. No. I'm not. I'm going to deny that okay. because I've never been there. So I don't know. It's not first on my list of places to go, but you can talk me into it.
All right. This is Las Vegas immersion for you. So it's this 3.5-day camp. They team you up with a, quote, rock counselor, and you learn how to write, produce, perform your very own rock anthem, ballad, what have you. And sort of first, for those real rock fans, they have real rock stars. Now, I'm thinking these folks are rock stars. If you're in Guns N' Roses or Bon Jovi, you'd qualify as a rock star, wouldn't you?
Sure.
So folks like
John
this,
Bon Jovi's there? Well, Axl Rose is there?
No, someone from their band.
I see. Okay.
But however,
the drummer.
However, Joe Perry of Aerosmith, one of my heroes, Paul, he will be there from June 4th. To 7. Let's find you a plane ticket. Let's go. Sign you up, my man.
I want to see you on stage.
I would love to meet Joe Perry of Aerosmith. I would become a rock performer.
Joe, if you're listening, the Adult Space Academy at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama, you say this will have a far better outcome than the movie Gravity. Did I give it a spoiler alert for that?
I expect that it will. It's funny. I almost sent my son to this camp several years ago. He was in his model rocket building phase, and I thought, oh, this is just perfect. But by the time I got to it, it was sold out. However, I believe there's more space available at
Wait a minute. You're comparing this to Gravity, and you're sending your son. What does that say?
He's adventurous.
Okay. All right.
He would absolutely be returning. But they actually have most of their camps at the U.S. Space Center in Huntsville are for kids, but they have a 2-night experience for adults. You can role play a mission. You get time and an actual simulator. They put you in something called the 1/6 gravity chair, and I don't know what that is, but
that's the vomit comet, I think.
Really?
I don't know.
It sounds like more fun when you say it's a gravity chair.
Yeah.
I'd like to feel like I'd be floating around somewhere. And you get to build and launch a model rocket. So there you go. Your 2-day adventure would be complete.
All right. Now, we have the CIA boot camp. You're actually recommending this. It's offered. It's the one offered by the Culinary Institute of America.
There you go. See, gotcha. You thought, CIA boot camp.
That's what I was thinking.
This is the preeminent cooking school in America, CIA.
Cooking in America.
Yes. Their main cooking school is in Hyde Park, New York, and you can do a 2-, 3-, 4-, 5-day cooking camp in Hyde Park, or go to St. Helena in the wine country in Northern California, or San Antonio, Texas, if you want to get a little bit closer to home. And it's everything hands-on learning with expert chefs, full days, and great food. You can't beat it. So if you really want to up your game in the kitchen as a cook.
I was wondering how you were going to work food into this conversation.
There you go. Oh, the CIA boot camp.
Amazing.
I hear it's awesome.
All right. Last but certainly not least is wine camp on Long Island.
And you do
now
not,
you're talking.
Now I'm talking. You now do not need talking. To be a wino, but it helps to be a wine connoisseur. Tastings, blends, history of wine. You learn how it's made. You get to bring home a case of wine. And this is the North Fork area of Long Island. It's actually turning into quite the wine region.
Hmm.
Beautiful area. Lots of B&Bs close to the beach, golf, these cute villages and whatnot. And again, you can decide that you want to be a slacker at wine camp. That's okay. You pays your money. It takes your chances.
Probably easy to
do
that.
There you go. And there's wine, lots of it. Or you can actually learn quite a bit and you return home and dazzle your friends. But however you slice it, it's going to be a good time.
And what kind of wine are we talking? Merlots, Zinfandels.
I do believe there are reds there. I think in the region they're doing both red and wine grapes. I'll stand corrected, but I think it's red and wine. But yeah, I know it's a growing wine region. I'm not super familiar with it. I've spent more time in Northern Ohio wine region in terms of in the area, Pennsylvania, Virginia, whatnot. So haven't gotten to this particular area.
Adult summer camp. Who knew? Elaine LaBalme knew. She's our travel contributor. Thank you, Elaine.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.FM or as a podcast in iTunes. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thanks for listening and so long for now.